All right, so we are up to 318. We finally finished the first parasha on Hashgacha. This one's a little shorter, but no less important. So we'll start with the English top of page 12. Having shown in the preceding chapter that of all living beings, mankind alone is directly under the control of divine providence, I will now add the following remarks. It is an established fact that the species have no existence except in our own mind. I think what he means is that the concept, the way we break things up, is not inherent, but it's a construct of the human mind. It's easier for us to organize things, and so we make up organizational groups. Species and other classes are merely formed in our minds, while everything in real existence is an individual object or an aggregate of individual objects, right? So even though we might have criteria, like biologists will have various hierarchies, genus and species and the like, and they'll make rules, but those rules aren't inherent. They just make things easier. It's like dividing by color or the like. This being granted, it must further be admitted that the result of an existing divine influence that reaches mankind through the human intellect. So once again, he's noting that the means by which Hashgacha takes place is through the human intellect. Remember the example he had before of the Hashgacha, that the Hashgacha is, we're on the towards the page 12, the Hashgacha is not that the ship with the hole will miraculously survive, but that the people won't go onto the ship.
And so is it, species have no existence except in our own minds?
Again, I think that means that the concept or the way in which we divide the species is a human construct. So we make up this form of classification to make it easier for us to relate to all the reality that we perceive. So we break things into groups.
Okay.
And we organize the groups the way that we do. So again, the way, the method of Hashgacha is through the human intellect is identical with the individual intellect. Well, let me read that sentence again. This being granted, it must be further admitted that the result of the existing divine influence that reaches mankind through the human intellect is identical with individual intellects really in existence, with which Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda are endowed. Hence, it follows, in accordance with what I've mentioned in the preceding chapter, that the greater the share in which a person has obtained of divine influence, on both accounts of his physical predisposition and his training. Physical might not be, I think, the exact word that we would use. The point is that he's saying that the greater connection we have to our Kadosh Baruch Hu through our intellect, the greater Hashgacha we'll have. Why does one person have more than another? It's a result of many things. His predisposition, his training, either way, however it is, nature, nurture, the person with the greater connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the greater must also be the effect of the divine providence upon him. For the action of divine providence is proportional to the endowment of the intellect, as having been mentioned above. Right, let's just look at the Hebrew. Ati hashgacha lav yoser bechreach, im hashgacha nimshachas achar hashseichel kamo shezacharti. So, the more there is this connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which takes place through the intellect, the greater the hashgacha will be, and he emphasizes that it's indeed proportionate. Just read one more translation, because this is a very important point. This is, in fact, maybe the central chiddush of the Rambam, that Hashgacha is dependent upon the madrega of the person. And many Rishonim will follow with this Mahalach of the Rambam. I'll just read you again the third translation. When any human individual is obtained because of the disposition of his matter and his training, a greater proportion of this overflow than others, Providence will of necessity watch more carefully over him than others. If, that is to say, Providence is, as I've mentioned, consequent upon the intellect. Accordingly, divine Providence does not watch in an equal manner over all individuals of the human species. But Providence is graded as their human perfection is graded. In accordance with this speculation, it follows necessarily that his providence may be exalted, that watches over the prophets is very great and proportionate to their degree in prophecy. And his providence that watches over excellent and righteous men is proportionate to their excellence and righteousness. For it is this measure of the overflow of the divine intellect that makes prophets speak. In other words, prophecy is also a reflection of that connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And again, though he does emphasize intellect, but it's important that it's not just intellect, because his examples are righteous, excellent and righteous men. He doesn't say smart or intellectual people. Doesn't say philosophers. He's talking about prophecy, and prophets, Nevi'im, have more hashgacha. Tzadikim have more hashgacha in proportionate to their righteousness. For it is this measure of the overflow of the divine intellect that makes prophets speak, guides the actions of righteous men. Again, notice actions. So it's again, we're not just talking about philosophizing. And perfects the knowledge of excellent men with regards to what they know. As for the ignorant and the disobedient, their state is despicable proportionately to their lack of this overflow, and they have been relegated to the rank of the individuals of all the other species of animals. He is like the beasts that speak not. Adam kebehemos nidmu, I think. No, that's probably not it. Right. So the point is, or let me just finish. For this reason, it is a light thing to kill them. Just like he said in the previous chapter, you can keep kill animals because they don't have hashgacha, so you can kill humans that don't have much hashgacha. What does he mean, you can kill humans? I think what he means is that the halachos of, let's say, moridin velo ma'alin, or lo ma'alin velo moridin, or things like that. The Rambam writes that in his famous palace metaphor, we should note, as the Chazon Ish points out, that those dinim don't apply anymore. And it's clear from the Chazon Ish, he's not just saying it, you know, apologetic, so people don't, they don't apply anymore. But there are dinim like that. What's the reason? And these dinim aren't even just punishments in the sense that there's been no trial. So what's the pshat? So first of all, why do you kill them? So I think the Rambam holds that the reason why you kill them is they're bad for society. But still, how can we justify it? The answer is, well, because they're humans acting as animals. They're not that different than animals. And so just like you're allowed to kill animals because there's no hashgacha, so it's not that it's mutter to kill them. That's not exactly what he said. But we don't have the same rules, right? For this reason, it's a light thing to kill them and has been even enjoined because of its utility. That's what I was referring to before. It's enjoined because of its utility. Why? Because these people are dangerous to society because of their bad beliefs. And therefore, because of the utility of killing them, because their being alive is dangerous, so therefore that is understood. This matter is one of the fundamental principles of the Torah, which is built upon it. I mean, to say upon the principle that Providence watches over each human individual in the manner proper to him. All right, so now this is a very interesting idea. Like I said, this idea, a little shocking, but Many Rishonim followed this path. The question is, how does it relate to what he told us in the previous chapter? Particularly, the Rambam told us in a previous chapter that one of the principles that we must uphold is justice. And that means that if a person suffers, it's because they're deserving of that suffering, and if they're rewarded, they're deserving of that reward. And even with respect to very small things, like stubbing your toe, as Chazal say, that's included in Hashgacha. Why is that a problem? Well, here's the problem. Here we're saying that, let's say somebody is not a very high madrega, so they don't experience much Hashgacha. So how could it be guaranteed that they deserve the things that they get? Because after all, they're not subject to Hashgacha. That's the question. Now, we could just say, well, it just means that they're not given special protection, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu will intervene to ensure that they're not harmed inappropriately, or for that matter, rewarded inappropriately. But the question is that really consistent? Because he just said that they don't have much hashgacha. They have almost no hashgacha. They're like an animal. So that's one of the biggest challenges in the Rambam. I mentioned before to you that there's a letter that Ibn Tibbon was very troubled by. This actually isn't his question. I was surprised. The question he has is a little, didn't even bother me, actually. But we'll get to that later. But that is this Yesod of the Rambam. So let's read on a little.
Ibn Tibbon was the translator of...
He was the translator of the Rambam. I was preferred translator from Provence. Of Marne Vuchem, among other things.
The original. So this is Ibn Tibbon original. Is that in Aramaic?
No, Arabic.
Arabic.
Yes. This translation over here is the Ibn Tibbon translation.
All the Marne Vuchems that you have on the shelf that are not English are Ibn Tibbon.
No, there are many others. There's a Kapach translation, Friedman translation. There are many, many translations, not just Ibn Tibbon. Ibn Tibbon is the most famous of the medieval ones. There are also other medieval ones, actually.
But he was the authorized, should we say.
He was the authorized, yeah. Which you might say, why would anybody do anything else? But it doesn't mean the Rambam reviewed it. And there are certain interesting choices that the Ibn Tibbon makes, which makes his translation extraordinary on the one hand, but also questionable on the other hand. Ibn Tibbon, for example, always will translate the same word in the same way. He'll never translate the same word in Arabic into two different Hebrew words, which makes for like some very funny reading sometimes. Like if you look at the mitzvah of Yerushalayim and Sefer Mitzvot, so he has something like Lahamin Yeraso, because he wants to translate the same word that he used for before on Emuna, so, and that's, he translates it Itakad, he has that as Lahamin, and then, so, like, some of, I forgot, one of the commentaries says, like, Milazu Enlo Muvat, it just doesn't make sense, not, this is, Ibn Tibbon had to make up words to like accommodate, to sort of translate, and that's well known. Not totally made up words, but sort of using words in new ways that they've never been used before. Anyway, whatever it is, it's a reason why tonight we've been using three translations is because I don't speak Arabic, so we're between the three of them. But I don't see much difference on these points so far. Let's read on a little. Consider in what way the texts of Scripture speak of providence, watching over the details of the circumstances of the avos in their various activities and even in their acquisition of property, and what they were promised in consequence of providence accompanying them. It was said of Avram, Anochi Magen Lach, and I'll switch back to this English, and to Yitzchak, I will be with thee, and I will bless thee, and to Yaakov, I am with thee, and I will keep thee. And to Moshe, chief of prophets, certainly, I will be with thee, and this shall not be a token unto thee. And to Yoshua, what?
It shall be a token.
There shall be a token. What's a token?
Zelcha Oath.
Zelcha Oath. Oh, it's an oath. Okay, good. And to Yehoshua, and I was with Moshe, so I'll be with you. It is clear that in these cases, the actions of providence has been proportional to man's perfection. So when we read Sefer Bereishis, we see tremendous hashgacha of the avos, and not only just hashgacha, but promises of hashgacha and protection and the like. An interesting question we have to think about is, are these terms perfection, protection and hashgacha being used interchangeably? That's an important question which we'll get back to. But al-Kopanim, the avos, because of their tremendous madrega, were zocha to tremendous hashgacha. The following verse describes how providence protects good and pious men and abandons fools. He will keep the feet of these of his saints, Raglei Chasidav Yishmor, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness. So what does it mean? The Psukim are telling us that Hashkacha is not equal to all people. For by the strength shall no man prevail. When we see that some men escape plagues and mishaps while others perish by them, we must not attribute this to a difference in the properties of their bodies or in their physical constitution, for by strength shall no man prevail. But it must be attributed to the different degrees of perfection. Now that's an interesting thing because, I mean, you go ahead and you see there's, I don't know, there's a plague in a particular city and 40% of the people die and 60% of the people live. So is he saying that has nothing to do with their health and genetics? It just has to do with their righteousness? And if that's true, how is that consistent with what he said in the previous paragraph? That the people are who are of a low madrega don't have any hashgacha, or almost no hashgacha. Okay, so let's...
Could I ask a question that might...
Yeah?
You might want to put a... It might not be a very short answer.
Okay.
I'm struggling to understand how this whole different levels of hashgacha tie into Yediyah and Bechira. Meaning...
Let's finish the paragraph.
Okay.
So how do we explain that some people lived and some people died? It must be attributed to the different degrees of perfection. Some approaching God while others moving away from him. Those who approach him are best protected, and he will keep the feet of thy saints, of his saints. And those who keep far away from him are left exposed to what may befall them. There is nothing that could protect them from what might happen. So again, we have this disease. Really, everybody should be by nature equally harmed, but because some people are zocha to higher hashgacha due to their righteousness, so they'll be protected. They're like those who walk in darkness and are certain to stumble. Those are the ones he doesn't protect. The protection of the pious by providence is also expressed in the following passages. He keeps all his bones. The eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous. He shall call upon me and I shall answer him. There are in Scripture many more passages expressing the principle that men enjoy divine protection in proportion to their perfection and piety. The philosophers have likewise discussed the subject. Abu Nasser, in his introduction to the commentary of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, says as follows: those who possess the faculty of raising their souls from virtue to virtue, chayil al-chayil, obtain, according to Plato, divine protection to a higher degree. So it doesn't say that Aristotle holds this. In fact, Aristotle doesn't, as he said before, but at least Plato was machad. So,
the other extreme.
Aristotle believed that there's no hashgacha for people.
Thought Plato thought there was no hashgacha at all.
No, that was the first. That was not Plato. What's his name?
Muslim guy.
No. The Muslims are the firm ones.
This is much earlier. The Greeks are much earlier.
Yeah. No. The first theory was the one that totally denied hashgacha was I forgot, but he totally Epicurus. Right. So now Plato does believe in Hashgacha, and that's why, like we said before, Plato also allows for Nisim. Okay, so again, what has he told us? He's told us that Hashgacha is commensurate to the degree of closeness that a person has for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he's quoted dozens of psukim, or a dozen psukim, and there really are many, many, many psukim that seem to say this. Now, is this the only way to explain these psukim? Not necessarily. You could read these psukim as saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects people. In other words, he prevents all harm from befalling the righteous, and adirabba, harm will befall the wicked. That's not because there's equal hashkacha for everybody. But the Rambam says, no, that's not what it sounds like. These psukim sound like Hashem will actually protect them, will be involved in them. The wicked are in the darkness. In other words, they're sort of left to randomness of nature, whereas those who are righteous are protected. They won't be harmed by the randomness of nature. That's the way the Rambam understands these psukim. Now, what does this have to do with Yediyah and Bechira? Well, I don't think it has anything to do with it. Bechira is that we have Bechira, so if you want to be a good person.
Right.
And Yediyah is simply that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what a person is going to choose freely, and so therefore he knows what's going to happen.
So Hashgacha is something the outside factors.
Yeah. So you're correct that Hashgacha, the Rambam here has not addressed the question of how does Hashgacha relate to Bechira.
Right.
You
discuss a little bit.
But it may very well be that, so elsewhere he does, we could address that, but likely the Rambam thinks that the protection that the righteous receive will prevent them from being unjustly harmed by the Bechira of other people. That's part of the Shmira. The Rambam elsewhere writes, "Yipol mitzidcha elef uvavami minecha elacha lo yigash." That means that because the tzaddik walks through, and to his right and to his left is death, destruction, war, even things that are impacted by bechira, and elacha lo yigash, you'll be saved. In fact, we've talked about the famous school of the Nefesh HaChaim. So the Rambam, in his own way, we'll see it a little bit later, it's in chapter 351, I think, or 354, I forgot, has his own version of it. The skula is not actually, again, he formulates it differently than the Nefesh HaChaim, but it's the same basic idea. It's the idea that if you're constantly connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you will be protected from all possible harm. That's what the Rambam writes, and that's consistent with what he says over here. It's sort of interesting. We'll have to return to this question when we get to those chapters. But he presents this idea, and then when he gets to that chapter, he's like, the most amazing revelation came to me that was almost like nevuah. That's what he writes. I think, you could read it differently. You could even say it was nevuah. And you're going to be so excited when I tell it to you. And then he says the same idea as he says over here. But clearly it's something very different. So I'll figure out why is it different? But that's what he writes over here. Let's finish the chapter. Now, consider how by this method of reasoning we have arrived at the truth taught by the prophets, that every person has his individual share of divine providence in proportion to his perfection. For philosophical research leads to this conclusion. If we assume, as has been mentioned above, that divine providence is in each case proportional to the person's intellectual development, it is wrong to say that divine providence extends only to the species and not the individual beings, as some of the philosophers teach. For only individual beings have real existence. An individual, right, like you said before, because the idea of a species is anyway made up, and individual beings are endowed with divine intellect. Divine providence acts, therefore, upon these individual beings. Study this chapter as it ought to be studied. You will find in it all the fundamental principles of the Torah. You will see that these are in conformity with philosophical speculation, and all difficulties will be removed. You will have a clear idea of divine providence. After having described the various philosophical opinions on providence and on the manner how God governs the universe, I'll briefly state the opinion of our co-religionists on the omniscience of God and what I have to remark on the subject. I don't think we're actually going to do the next chapter, because it relates to Ashgacha, but not directly. It relates to the nature of Yediyas Hashem. In other words, how God knows what's going on in the world. I think we're going to actually go to the end of the book, where he returns to the top of Kashkacha. We might also refer a little bit before we skip to his parish on Eov, which is also very much related to Hashgacha, because the Rambam thinks that all the different opinions in Eov, that is, Eov's opinion, his three friends, Elihu, so there are five basic views on Hashgacha, all correspond to the five different views that he mentioned before. And he explains how a lot of the dialogue in Eov, which seems to be like very repetitive, very complex, but it's not always clear how, like, what's new. And, you know, like, then Elihu comes and he seems to say more of the same things, and somehow or another it's totally different than everybody before him. Very hard book. But anyway, he shows how these five views of the five characters of Eov correspond to the five views of Hashgacha, namely the four wrong opinions and the fifth opinion. Naturally, Elihu is the Torah's opinion, the like. So we'll see a little bit about that. I don't think we're going to go through all the details. But the big question that remains, which I'm not going to answer tonight because we're out of time. I don't even know if I know the answer. I have some thoughts, but I'm not really sure what the answer is.
You can try them on us next week.
Maybe we will, or maybe we should wait till the end. I'm not sure. I have a bunch of theories, but I'm not really sure. But I'll give them to you. And I'd like to hear your thoughts as well. But I want you to keep an open mind and not be, because maybe you all understand this better than me. But the Iker point, I think, the Iker question that remains is, how does chapter 18 relate to chapter 17? And in particular, how does what he says in 18, which is that lots of people lack hashgacha, correspond to the absolute assurance of divine justice. L'chora, if you don't have hashgacha, then the things that happen to you are random, in which case they are not just. So that's a question. And that's what we need to think about over the course of the week.
Isn't that the form of justice?
Well,
form of justice is you don't have hashgacha and you're on
so
your own.
So you could say that. You could say lack of hashgacha is a punishment. But when you're in that state of punishment, if you're left to the forces, random forces of nature, then you might turn out very well and you might turn out very poorly, and that seems to be totally unfair.
Didn't work out for Paro.
Is Rambam bothered by somebody getting things better than he deserves?
He does. He gives that. Go back to 317. He gave both examples. He says that, so let's see, where was that? That was towards... another fundamental principle from page 8. Take a look. Middle of page 8. Even when a person suffers in consequence of a thorn having entered into his hand, although it is drawn out, it is a punishment inflicted on his sins. And the least pleasure he enjoys, right? So he feels good. He enjoys whatever, the sun shining on him, a nice piece of fruit. Whatever it is, right? The least pleasure, minimum, is a reward for some good action. And that is part of Kichol Derachav Mishpat. So he has both. But you hear the kasha.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the kasha. But he told us that we have to read this chapter really carefully. Maybe if you read it again. He didn't want you to just read the chapter the way we did. He wanted you to read it very carefully and again and again and again. So that's the homework. All right.
When he says das and noshi, co-religionists, that means like the Greeks and the...
No, I think he means other Jews. Fellow Yidden.
Co-religionists.
We're co-religionists.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean...
The ways no...
Pumpkin dust and no sheet.
No, you know what? Actually, you might be right. It says over here, this is how they translated that. After we have mentioned the opinion of the people engaged in speculation concerning providence and the manner in which God governs the world, I shall sum up for you the opinion of the people of our religious community concerning knowledge. Yeah. Okay. So co-religionists means us.
Okay.
But again, this next chapter is really about divine knowledge, which relates to Hashgacha, but not directly on Hashgacha. But maybe it is more direct, I just didn't understand it. Okay, you want to talk about Tfilas Azar?
Yeah.